from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, an olive branch from Iran, terror in Nairobi, and Dr. Seuss gets pulled into Washington politics. At the United Nations in New York, Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, took the stage to call for a new day, new relations.
Let me say loud and clear that peace is within reach.
At a glossy mall in Kenya, terror. Somalia's Al-Shabaab, nearly 70 dead. One survivor said he thought he was going to die. He covered himself in blood.
They thought I was going to die. I took the blood that I was covered with. I rubbed it on my face so that when they came there, they see like I'm dead.
And in the U.S. Senate, divisive, determined, high-drama Republican Ted Cruz of Texas spoke for 21 hours straight, threw Dr. Seuss into the Obamacare battle.
Do you like green eggs and ham? I do not like them, Sam I Am. I do not like green eggs and ham.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, David Sanger of the New York Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you make of the shutdown drama, Iran's overture? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. We'll ask if she likes green eggs and ham. Nancy, welcome back. Great to have you.
It was a lovely bedtime story.
Oh, yes, but nobody was snoozing. Well, he wasn't anyway. And from Washington, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal. David Sanger, busy week. Welcome back to you as well.
Thanks. Great to be back with you. I'm actually in New York, thanks.
Oh, okay.
All of the UN activities.
Yes, perfect. Great to have you from New York. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and David.
We have got so much to look at on this shutdown Affordable Health Care Act front, but let's just hear some of the sound of this week. Here was the president responding to the onslaught from at least portions of the Republican Party.
No Congress before this one has ever in history been irresponsible enough to threaten default, to threaten an economic shutdown, to suggest America not pay its bills, just to try to blackmail a president into giving them some concessions on issues that have nothing to do with the budget.
Not ever, ever. And he's moving right on to default there. We'll look at that. Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas was still in the budget brigade here, talking all night, making this plea near the end of his 21-hour speech on the Senate floor.
My plea to this body is that we listen to the American people, because if we listen to our constituents, the answer is defund this bill that isn't working, that's hurting the American people, that's killing jobs, that's forcing people into part-time work, that's driving up health insurance premiums, and that's causing millions to lose or fear that they will lose their health insurance.
Okay, I don't know what the world is thinking of this. Americans themselves maybe not sure what to think of it. We'll look at the politics, but Nancy, at this point, could you please simply lay out for us what are the realistic options? Are we headed for a shutdown? Is there a realistic way of avoiding it now? Does it affect the implementation of Obamacare?
Well, there are several ways that we could avoid a shutdown, and there are several ways that we could be facing a shutdown. It's just too hard to say right now, mm-hmm. Tom. The Senate is voting on Friday, holding the rest of its votes on this bill to fund the government. They're going to strip out that measure that House Republicans inserted that defunds the president's health care law. Then they're sending it back to the House. And the big question is, what do House Republicans do next? They've already said point blank they can't accept this bill as is. And if they can't defund the president's health care law, they're going to try some other route, some other way to hurt the health care law. So they've got a few different options they're looking at. Now, of course, you've got Senate Democrats saying, well, you could try that, but then you're just courting a government shutdown because we are not going to accept it. So you've got a standoff. You've got the possibility that we could have a one-week extension, basically fund the government for a week so they can keep on duking this out.
Oh,
but as
heavens.
You've already alluded to,
I don't know.
My family may disown me if that happens.
Yes.
But, you know, the problem is that we've got this other fight looming. The Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew, already said this week that the debt ceiling needs to be lifted by October 17th.
Wow.
That is three weeks away.
That's 5 seconds from now.
So you spend another week fighting over funding the government, and you really run into a wall. And that is the fight that many people think could really, truly be calamitous from an economic perspective.
And certainly Jack Lew said so. David Sanger, we heard the president right there complaining bitterly about what's happening here, already moving on to the default issue. That is the debt ceiling issue. How's the White House looking at the budget and defunding business in front of us right now, David?
Well, I think they believe that the chances of a defunding of Obamacare is pretty low. It's interesting that the Senate vote was 100-0, including Ted Cruz voting for a resolution that 3 days before he said would be the equivalent of voting for Obamacare. But there are all kinds of creative explanations I'm sure one could come up with.
Green eggs for breakfast, and you never know what you'll do.
But, you know, what's amazing to me, usually in Washington, the most interesting question is, what are you not debating? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So Obamacare, whether you like it or whether you hate it, is a relatively tiny part of the budget. And if you believe the CBO estimates will actually reduce the budget deficit over 10 years. Now, you can argue about whether you believe those numbers or not, but it's fundamentally not a significant revenue issue and not a significant cost issue as a percentage of an overall, $3.8 trillion budget, right?
Yeah.
So the big issues are defense. Remember sequester, which we spent a lot of time discussing in 4 or 5 months ago. Medicare and Social Security. You look at the pie chart of the federal budget, and you put those together, and it's easily more than 2/3 of the total budget. And what is completely missing from this discussion is what you do with the biggest part of the budget. And, you know, these are all issues we've kicked down the road. We've got endless commissions and so forth and so on. And to some degree, we're doing everything but addressing the central issues.
Well, I mean, you may be right, but and we'll soon be hearing about all that, the big default and debt stuff, and, of course, Medicare and Social Security right in the middle of that. But, I mean, Cruz and his supporters will talk about how wide that circle is. I'm not sure at this point, but they profess fundamental problems with Obamacare itself. I mean, here he was, part of that 21-hour speech again, making an equivalency between implementing Obamacare, dealing with the White House on that, and Neville Chamberlain sort of going soft on Adolf Hitler.
Look, we saw in Britain Neville Chamberlain, who told the British people, accept the Nazis. Yes, they'll dominate the continent of Europe, but that's not our problem. Let's appease them. Why? Because it can't be done. We can't possibly stand against them. And in America, there were voices that listened to that. I suspect those same pundits who say it can't be done, if it had been in the 1940s, we would have been listening to them.
All right, Nancy Cordes, I mean, David's exactly right. There are bigger fish to fry here, and those will be on the griddle in no time at all. But just for one more time, review for us, what is it that has Ted Cruz and Republicans who are in his camp, a lot of Tea Party members of the House, so bitterly opposed, even at this almost-to-be-implemented hour, to Obamacare?
Well, I'll tell you that his comments about Nazi appeasers really alienated some members of his own party, because that was really a veiled reference to other Republicans who he says aren't fighting Obamacare as hard as he is. And comparing them to Nazi appeasers did not sit well with Senator John McCain, for one, who went to the Senate floor and said, I don't appreciate that at all. And then Senator Cruz kind of backtracked and said, well, I wasn't referring to you or any other senators. I was talking to anonymous about anonymous pundits. Basically, the problems that Cruz has, which he laid out over the course of 21 hours, is that, first of all, he thinks it's a big government program and that we should be moving towards the free market. He thinks that some people are getting dumped off of their company's health insurance plan as companies try to comply with this Leviathan new law. He feels that other people are getting cut back to part-time work because companies don't want to have to comply with the law, and they know that if they cut people's hours back, then they don't have to offer them health insurance, and so on and so forth. The problem is, and the argument that most Senate Republicans have been making, aside from Senator Cruz and a handful of others, is Yes, we completely agree with you. We don't like this law any more than you do. We hate it. That's why we've been fighting against it for 4 years now, way before you were in the Senate, back when this law was being crafted. But we don't think that we don't have the votes to defund it. So don't make this last stand now and look like we are holding up government funding and courting a shutdown when in the end this strategy just won't work.
Jack, what do you think is going on at bottom here? What are we witnessing?
Well, we're witnessing a kind of AstroTurf moment, I think. There was a piece in the Washington Examiner this week that pointed out that the group of the public for which Cruz is speaking, he's really speaking for Heritage Action, the Club for Growth, Freedom Works. That is effectively his whip operation. Those groups are calling congressmen every day, inundating them with calls. That isn't the public. That's these groups, and they're whipping up a lot of anger from Republicans who resent it.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news: shutdown fever, Iran's charm offensive, carnage in a Kenyan mall. Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News, is here. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, is with us. Our own Jack Beatty. Lots of reaction online. Gary says, look, government debt is an issue that should not be linked to the Affordable Care Act. Zach writes, look, government debt shouldn't be linked. How do you propose it's paid for? Our money is debt. And that kind of conversation is going to get even bigger in the days ahead. Here's John Boehner, House Speaker. The president had said he doesn't want to negotiate over the debt ceiling, which is there right after the budget. Boehner says not so fast.
Now, the president says, I'm not going to negotiate. Well, I'm sorry, but it just doesn't work that way. We're not going to ignore Washington's spending problem, and we're not going to accept this new normal of a weak economy, no new jobs, and shrinking wages.
David Sanger, how do you see leverage sorting out here as we head into this next, it's pretty fast, rush on to the debt ceiling issue? Who's got the leverage here?
Well, it is pretty fast, and the answer to the question is the president doesn't have the leverage, the Congress doesn't have the leverage, but some guy you never heard of at Standard & Poor's has all the leverage. Okay, so let's back up to why that is. First of all, the debt ceiling doesn't affect in any way spending. All it affects is borrowing for spending you've already done. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I hate the analogies that bring it from, you know, doing a federal budget to your home budget, because usually when you hear those, you know the analogy isn't going to work. But one that isn't so bad is you've spent all this money and then you decide you're not going to pay the credit card company. Okay, yeah. And what's the result of that? Your credit rating's going to go down. And what's the result for us? Well, our credit rating's already gone down once, and we could get dropped another notch or two. And frankly, the president and the Congress have no control over that. Three credit rating agencies do.
And with that, the economy gets knocked back, Wall Street gets knocked back, we're presumably back on our heels.
They could be. You know, last time they really weren't. I mean, the market is up considerably from where it was when this happened last time. So why is that? That's because interest rates have stayed low in the United States for all kinds of reasons relating to the Fed, and because dysfunctional as the U.S. Congress may seem on being able to deal with budgets and doing this in an orderly fashion, the rest of the world, starting with Europe, looks even more dysfunctional, and the Chinese are slowing down. So those have all, you know, it's all a matter of comparison of where one wants to go put their money. The difficulty here is that these downgrades and these credit issues are never a problem until the day they are. You know, financial crises don't happen slowly. They happen in a big rush when suddenly there's a loss of confidence. You saw that
sure.
in 2009.
Yep.
That's just the way these run. And so you can go through a credit downgrade and maybe a second one, and investors shrug it off and they think sooner or later they're going to get paid back, until that moment when the U.S. government actually doesn't pay them back, which has never happened. And at that point, you've suddenly changed the game. But remember, the debt limit isn't about spending. It's about paying back what you've
already It's about the good faith and credit of the U.S. government. I mean, you've got Harry Reid, Nancy, saying this is a Thelma and Louise move by the Republicans. Who's going to go over the cliff? But then you heard John Boehner right there saying, no, it's about spending and it's about indebtedness. And we want to address this right now. Who do you see in a better position vis-a-vis leverage with American public opinion? And what's the Republican political calculation here, Nancy?
Well, I think the challenge for Republicans when it comes to public opinion in this fight is that back in 2011, when they had a similar fight, they said, OK, we will raise the debt ceiling, but only if you cut the debt. Let's do that. And that was something that was easy for the American public to understand. People said, yeah, that makes sense. You know, our debt shouldn't be this high to begin with. If we're going to raise the debt ceiling, tit for tat, great. The problem now is that the laundry list of things that they are asking for in exchange for their votes to raise the debt ceiling, in many cases, has nothing to do with the debt. It's a laundry list of Republican priorities. The Keystone XL oil pipeline, more offshore oil drilling, rewriting ash coal regulations, all kinds of things that House Republicans have passed this year. But because they don't control the Senate, those bills end up dying. And so they're trying to make this argument, you need to do all of these things in order for us to raise the debt ceiling. And Americans don't necessarily see the equivalence there. And that's when you start to hear the president and Harry Reid saying, you know, this is a hostage taking, this is blackmail. And so that does hurt the Republican argument. You see that in the polls right now that people say, yes, you know, even people who oppose the president's health care law say, I oppose it, but I don't think that you should shut the government down or risk a default of U.S. credit because of it.
Jack, what do you think of Ted Cruz in the middle of all this? First term senator, Republican out of Texas. He's made so many waves. Stick a dynamite in there. Is he clearing a way for himself? He's said to have presidential ambitions. Or is he, you know, going to be seen as the Thelma and Louise guy taking everything over the cliff?
It sounds like the latter. I mean, he's not, as I said earlier, he's not speaking for the public. I meant he's not speaking for the public about shutting down the government. Mm. The poll on that is 59 to 19. He's speaking for that 19%.
I see.
Mm-hmm. He's in his own echo chamber. He's an interesting type. I mean, he's a Princeton debate champion, and he really handles himself very well on his feet, but he doesn't speak with any affection for exactitude. He's government takeover of healthcare and all the rest. And it's hard, you know, people are using the analogy of a shooting star, that he'll go up and he'll come down. On the other hand, I saw references this week. I saw quotations out of South Carolina from Republicans down there. I saw references in Iowa, people out there in the Republican Party saying, hey, this is what we want. We, you know, Obamacare is just this dangerous to the economy. He's the only guy with the guts doing it. And more power to him. On the other hand, you had Peter King, and I think he speaks for a lot of Republican colleagues. He called him, quote, a holier-than-thou fraud. So take your pick.
Let's go to Georgia, Augusta, Georgia, and Gail. Gail, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Thank you, Tom. I think that these grown men that are actually acting like adolescents should stop and use the power that they have. Instead of passing the same money around and around and around the world in markets, have these in a pipeline like they're talking about. Look what happened in Boulder, Colorado. If a 500-ton rock happened to fall on that pipeline, we would be in big trouble. And also, they can use their influence to do smart things like startup companies to fix the infrastructure. Our bridges are falling down. Our roads are gone to completely.
Yeah, and here we are debating this, and it sounds like you got a little Keystone pipeline or oil pipeline in the background. There's been talk and negotiation there. Gail, let us hold that. No thanks for the preaching, you say. Beth in Niskayuna, New York. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I was going to say there's two things. They can pass the budget piecemeal. And since the president is willing to say, and by the way, the pipeline is already, he's part of it already has been signed. But if he's willing to say, oh, I am willing to fund that, I will sign that if you will let my beloved law go through. There's no – game is over.
You're talking Keystone Pipeline, tar sands out of Canada, all that.
Yeah, yeah. And the effect in Canada is already – there's the effect in Canada. If you have seen the megastructure in Canada – that is tied to that, the tar sand structure. You're not going to want anything to do with it.
Let's pick it up right there, Beth. David Sanger, the president says he won't negotiate over this, but is there negotiation going on already over the debt ceiling, even around the pipeline?
One of the oddities is that in past cases we have seen negotiations going on. In this case, and you know, can always be happening in ways you don't see and in phone calls you never hear about and all that. But there isn't a whole lot of evidence that there is much negotiation going on. But, you know, I think that Nancy raised a very important issue, which was, first you have the question of the debt ceiling. Then you have the question of linking the debt ceiling to spending cuts, which was a perfectly good idea if you're trying to enforce a discipline of dealing with spending cuts. Although, why would Congress need to be enforced on that? Now you're dealing with basically other policy issues that have nothing to do with the debt. It's a very crazy way of doing a budget.
Dave in Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling about green eggs and ham.
Okay.
The premise of that story is that it's pretty silly to decide you don't like something that you haven't tried. It looks to me like Cruz and Company are afraid that once America tries Obamacare, they may like it. So I think that we're seeing Cruz and his colleagues being silly and irrelevant.
Silly and irrelevant. You want the end of the book that where they turn around and say, I like green eggs. I would eat them in a boat. I would eat them with a goat. Nancy, what about that? This idea that this is desperate because people are afraid if it goes into effect and begins to work, Republicans are afraid they'll never be able to reel it back in.
Well, and they do see their opportunities for fighting this law dwindling. Next week, the insurance exchanges go into effect. In January, the individual mandate goes into effect. As each new piece goes into effect, it gets more and more difficult to unwind. So that's why you're seeing this sort of big last stand on the part of these Republicans who say, if we don't fight it now, we may not have another chance. You have the president, on the other hand, making a sort of rip-roaring speech on Thursday saying, you know, when this all gets implemented and people are happy with their choices and it's going well in a couple of years, the Republicans aren't going to be calling it Obamacare anymore. They're going to like it and they're going to say, you know, I was for that all the time. Now, who knows if that's true or not? And privately, Democrats will admit that there are a lot of problems that need to be ironed out. Publicly, they're not as candid about that. But I don't think you'll see a real effort between Republicans and Democrats to try to fix some of those problems until everything is implemented, because otherwise Democrats give Republicans a big window to say, aha, we were right, it's not working, and Republicans are still focused very much right now on trying to scrap the whole thing altogether. They don't want to fix little pieces.
Yeah, going to be darn hard to say I was for it all along after all of this theater, and more than theater, this really tough hardball politics of the last couple of weeks, and that's not over. We've got to turn to Iran. Very new tone and feel to the comments of the new president of Iran before he came to New York and the United Nations, in New York at the United Nations. John Kerry, Secretary of State, having the highest level meeting in decades just in the last 24 hours. Here's a little bit of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani at the UN on Tuesday, speaking through an interpreter here.
Nuclear weapon and other weapons of mass destruction have no place in Iran's security and defense doctrine and contradict our fundamental religious and ethical convictions.
We've heard that kind of thing before, but scarcely in this context, in this tone, for a long, long time. David Sanger, has this conversation between the U.S. and Iran moved to a new track in the last week?
It has certainly moved to a new tone, and it may be, it seems to be, about to move to a new track. The question is it moving to a new conclusion? So I would say that President Rouhani has been on the most remarkable charm offensive in the past week. There's few people that he hasn't seen in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I was with a group that listened to him and asked a number of questions last night. Few observations from that.
Yes, please.
First, compared to sitting down with President Ahmadinejad, which I probably did three or four times during the time he was in office and would come to New York, the answers are short, they are crisp, sometimes they are evasive, frequently they are funny.
Mm-hmm.
Second, he seems very comfortable in his skin. At one point in the course of our meeting last night, The Iranian foreign minister, known to many of us because he used to be the ambassador to the United Nations, came in from that meeting with John Kerry. The president invited him up to the podium and said, what did you hear? How'd it go? This was before he had had any particular briefing from the foreign minister himself. And he gave a brief summary. It was more like dealing with ordinary countries and, you know, what you might see among, you know, Europeans or Asian allies who came in to such sessions. So that was all the good news. The bad news out of this is, or potentially bad news, is we don't know how much freedom Mr. Rouhani has. So we don't know if he is truly the moderate that he claims to be, and he used that word many times, if he is instead faking this because he thinks it will get them to sanctions relief, or if he's sincere in it but may not have the juice to go deliver it over the objections of either the Supreme Leader or the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which runs the nuclear program.
I mean, there's an interesting sort of back and forth on exactly that. What does he mean? What does it stand for? Point on the issue of the Holocaust. He talked with Christian Amanpour with CNN on Tuesday, this interview, and Amanpour cited Ahmadinejad, as you say, his denial of the Holocaust, and asked the new Iranian president, Rouhani, about his position of the Holocaust. Do you accept what it was, she asked. And Rouhani, interpreted by CNN, and hang on to that thought, responded, I've said before that I'm not an historian, and when it comes to speaking of the dimensions of the Holocaust, he uses the word there, it is the historians that should reflect on it. He went on to say,
in general, I can tell you that any crime that happens in history against humanity, including the crime the Nazis created towards the Jews, is reprehensible and condemnable. Whatever criminality they committed against the Jews, we condemn. The taking of human life is contemptible. It makes no difference whether that life is a Jewish life, Christian, or Muslim. For us, it is the same.
Jack Beatty, this is certainly the voice right here of moderation. And he uses the word Holocaust. He calls it reprehensible and condemnable. But then it wasn't long before the semi-official news agency out of Iran came out saying CNN had fabricated portions of this, that he didn't use the word Holocaust, that he never characterized Nazi mass murder as reprehensible. CNN absolutely sticks by its interpretation, though. Jack, what are you seeing here?
Well, I think it's a reflection of his domestic politics. He's he represents one side of an Iranian possibility. The other side, as Dexter Filkins points out in an excellent piece in this week's New Yorker, is represented by a man named Soleimani. He's the head of the Quds Force. He's running, pretty much running the military show in Syria, and he is very much a hardliner. He has the blood of hundreds of Americans on his hands from supplying weapons in Iraq, and he has the Iraqis essentially under his thumb. I mean, he effectively picked their current president, and through Iraq is supplying Syria. That is the other side of the Iranian government.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, on San Francisco Bay, Larry Ellison's Oracle Team USA and controversial space-age catamaran won the America's Cup sailing regatta there in an incredible comeback on Wednesday. Over Emirates Team New Zealand, skipper of the American boat, Australian Jimmy Spithill, gave props to his team.
It didn't matter if you were a designer on the team, it didn't matter if you were, you know, a short-term member, a cleaner, or a sailor, it didn't matter. You just wanted it, and you would just do whatever it took, and you knew you would just fight all the way to the end.
And they did. Last night in New York, fans chanted, "We want Mo," as Yankees man Mariano Rivera pitched his final game after 19 seasons as the best closer in baseball. Rivera was ready to say goodbye.
I had the opportunity to play for 19 years and give the best of my talents and my ability to this organization. And tonight was paid off. You know, I mean, the fans were there, and I definitely appreciate that.
And what have we got? All-girl bluegrass quintet Della May snagged Emerging Artist of the Year prize at the International Bluegrass Music Awards. They've played for us at On Point Live. Here's the title track off their latest album, This World Oft Can Be.
The lines on your face tell me something's troubling. Has the day and its weight made it feel old again? Let up a pile of kittens.
Della May, we knew them when. Check out their On Point Live performance from last summer at onpointradio.org. We're looking at a week in the news. Shutdown fever, Iran's charm offensive, carnage in a Kenyan mall. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, is here. Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News, and our own Jack Beatty. David Sanger, I think you in the room with the Iran's president had some conversation about this Holocaust interview.
Well, the moderator at the panel that I was at asked him about the Holocaust thing and this whole translation question. By the way, I believe it was an official Iranian translator that CNN was using at that time.
Okay.
So that, and for whatever that adds to it.
It
doesn't, I'm told by Persian speakers, it doesn't sound like he used the word Holocaust. In any case, he was asked about it last night, and here's essentially what he said. He said, the Nazi regime killed many, many people in highly condemnable action, and that included in that group were many Jews, and that Iran condemned all of the killings. And then he went on to say, in something of an interesting kind of half-backtracking, but that is no excuse for penalizing any other group that had nothing to do with it, which was a clear reference to the Palestinians.
And you're talking in this meeting, in this other, not in the Amanpour interview, but in the meeting you attended?
In the meeting that I attended.
Yes, I see.
Which was Thursday night in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So he clearly had heard all of this dispute. But what was interesting is that the first part of the answer didn't really back away from condemning the killings. It just generalized it to the fact that it was not just Jews who were killed, but he mentioned and condemned the fact that Jews were among those killed.
I mean, I'm trying to feel your bottom line in this. This seems to be far away from Ahmadinejad's.
I have asked the same question of Ahmadinejad when he was here and got very different answers.
Yeah.
I would get answers like, well, historians need to examine this to see if any of this was true. There was none of that.
Let's go to Al in Louisville, Kentucky. Al, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Two words for Iran. Enthusiastic caution. Or like I was told, trust but verify.
Yeah. So you're ready to talk. You're ready to pursue this opening, this charm offensive.
Yes, because it's been too long. It's been too long to have this conversation, but we need to hold their feet to the fire.
But have the conversation, hold the feet to the fire, but let's get into it. That seems to be pretty much, from the outside anyway, the Obama White House approach. Al, I appreciate your call from Louisville. Justin in New Haven, Connecticut. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hi.
I think we have to fully explore the route of trying to resolve this through diplomatic means. But, I think we really have to take into account the 30 years plus of history we have with this with the Iranian government. They may have a new president who is posing as a reformist, but I think that just shows us that the sanctions, if they've achieved anything, it's basically convinced the Iranians that they have to change their tone. I think everyone knows that the supreme leader makes all the calls. He has the final decision on everything, and he himself has not made any conciliatory statements or gestures. Reality is he actually he's almost contradicting the statement that the president's making at the UN.
Well, I mean, the supreme leader, Khamenei, did say he's calling for heroic flexibility. That doesn't sound like nothing. Yes, we've got 30 years history. I guess, Iranians say we've got 60 years history with you, United States. You overthrew our elected government in 1953. The president himself talked about that from the podium this week. But even there, with your more cautious tone, Justin, I'm hearing, let's check it out. Nancy Cordes, what's the attitude you've seen, the reaction on the Hill toward the charm offensive?
I think it's very similar to what your callers have been saying. In fact, We saw the chair and the ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee put out an op-ed this week essentially saying, look, the media blitz has been interesting, but what really matters is what he does with his first 100 days in office. Does he have the blessing of the Ayatollah? And will he show more willingness to commit to a freeze in Iran's nuclear program than his predecessor? And so, you know, they like what they're hearing from them, but they say, you know, what's really important is actions, not words.
Yeah, I mean, there's also, of course, action on Syria in the UN this week, but still verification to come there. Jack, here's a listener, Ron, writes on Facebook, says the Obama administration just scored major victories by not only getting Syria to admit they have chemical weapons, but to pledge to give them up. They also got Russia and China in the same room to help without bombing anyone. Also, communications opening with Iran. But fright wingers, Ron writes, are still barking about how Obama is a foreign affairs failure. What about Syria and the bigger picture this week, Jack? A big president, small president, medium president on the world stage?
Well, a president who, for the first time, I think, is upside down in foreign policy. He's had good ratings all along and now negative higher than positive. So the public is saying we don't like the way he's doing things.
What does that mean? We wanted bombs away?
I don't know. You'd have to look into the data. Yep. But I think it's just that there people are reacting to the on-again, off-again quality of things, the improvised quality of so much of what's going on. On the other hand, the Times story today, I think, is pretty clear. That is a significant diplomatic victory to have the Chinese and the Russians agree that the UN is going to have this protocol, this, you know, essentially diktat to Syria, and Syria has got to conform. Admittedly, they back away from putting force into the resolution, but there is other language in there that you could construe. The United States could well construe to mean force. So that looks like at least a provisional victory for the president.
Here's the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, talking about all this and the Security Council action. This was on Thursday night.
This resolution will require the destruction of a category of weapons that the Syrian government has used ruthlessly and repeatedly against its own people. And this resolution will make clear that there are going to be consequences for noncompliance.
David Sanger, does the Security Council resolution make that clear? Consequences for noncompliance?
It says there will be consequences. It doesn't specify what they will be. But it does say that they would be taken up under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which means that's the chapter in which you can authorize military force or other sanctions.
And Russia and China voted for that.
Russia and China voted for that because they'd have to come back to the UN and they could always veto it then. But that said, let's separate out your question of, mm-hmm. What was victory and what was not here. In Syria, the president got to a good place after the worst possible process. Okay, I mean, they went back and forth.
The threats and then the...
Syria, yeah. threatened a tomahawk strike that he didn't do, went to Congress and discovered Congress wouldn't go along, ended up getting a resolution out of the UN that nobody thought was possible a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's where he was there. On Iran, I would say this is more the product of good, long, steady planning. As one of your callers indicated earlier, this is one of those rare moments where it looks like sanctions actually work.
Yeah.
We haven't seen that since South Africa, right?
Yeah.
So that tells you something. It was a much better, much more comprehensive, organized sanction effort than you saw during the Bush administration, oddly enough. And it seems like it had a significant political effect, and Rouhani said as much.
When will we know if it's for real, David? What will be the agreement with the IAEA, or you name it, that the Iranians make that puts, transparency enough in their nuclear program in a new way, I guess, that the world can say, yes, they're moving on that?
Transparency alone would not be enough.
Okay.
What would you need? First, you'd probably need a deconstruction of enough of the nuclear infrastructure they've put together that the U.S. and the West would have an assurance that if there was a race for a bomb, they would have a year or two's notice.
And you don't mean that in an academic way. You mean tear it down, tear some of it
down.
That
means tear it down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when Rouhani was the nuclear negotiator years ago, they had 164 centrifuges. Today, they have 18,000. Those are the machines that spin uranium and enrich it. Now, all the 18,000 are operating right now, but with 18,000, you can make a lot more progress a lot more quickly. Secondly, they're probably going to have to open up some facilities that they have never allowed full access to, including their deep underground site. Thirdly, they'll probably have to put some caps on the production. And fourthly, they're going to have to figure out what they're going to do about a plutonium reactor that's about to go into operation within a year or two there. And then the last, and my guess is the hardest, is to answer the International Atomic Energy Agency's questions of many years about evidence that they worked on a weapon. A man most Americans have never heard of, named Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who is the believed to be the head of the weapon side of the project, has never been allowed to be questioned, nor have the thousands of scientists working for him. That's the part the West has got to worry about the most, because that's the part where they talk about moving from a peaceful to a non-peaceful program.
I mean, but I think, David, if I may, forgive me, but I think I heard Kenneth Pollack say the other day, I think that the likely meeting place, if there is one to be had here, is that would leave Iran without the bomb, but with peaceful nuclear power, but within range of making a bomb. Can you imagine that being, can you see that being accepted by the U.S., by Israel?
It depends on how long that range is. You know, Japan is there.
Right.
They do nuclear power. Obviously, they have the technological capability to build a weapon, and we live with that because we think we'd have enough warning and we fundamentally trust the Japanese. I can imagine that the U.S. will have to move off of its position of not one centrifuge spins. They'll have to leave some enrichment capability inside Iran. The question is whether it's a small enough enrichment capability that you'd have warning time.
Yeah, there we are. We will watch that space. Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Sam.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You know, you can't help but wonder what things would be like in Iran if we hadn't have taken out Mossadegh. And in a similar way, I wonder how things would have turned out in downtown Kenya if we hadn't gone into Kenya. And what I'm talking about is the backstory in Kenya that mostly you don't hear too much about. And specifically, it was, you know, right after 9/11 when Bush put, you know, all those warlords in Somalia on the CIA payroll to start hunting for Al-Qaeda. And I believe I recall at the time that experts were saying there were maybe a dozen Al-Qaeda in Somalia at the time. And these warlords, you know, because we use such a blunt instrument, were pretty brutal, and they started killing, you know, hundreds of people in Somalia. And the Somalis said, you know, enough of this. And that's when the Islamic Courts Union was put together to go after these warlords and take them out.
Sam, hold it right there if you'd be good enough. Our time is short. I mean, having spent time in Somalia, I can tell you there were plenty of warlords killing plenty of people there long before 2001, and there were Islamic courts long before 2001. But I don't know the backstory here. Do you see how much international webbing that might stretch as far as the United States do you see in the Nairobi situation, David Sanger?
You know, I see some, but, you know, in the Nairobi situation, you're dealing with a Somali-based group that the U.S. has tried to deal with in Somalia, and the difficulty has always been one of entering a space that has no working government, and secondly, the question of how much intrusion into a foreign sovereign area you want to go. And obviously, we do this with drones in Pakistan, in Yemen, and to some degree, we've done it in Somalia. Right now, this group does not have reach to the United States, but clearly one of the reasons the FBI is so deeply involved in this investigation is to begin to understand more about their internal organization so you know if they would have reach into the United States.
Yeah, I think we're going to learn a lot more out of that whole situation. We had the Kenyan president saying that they've shamed and defeated the attackers, but now news reports here saying Kenyan forces may have caused the mall collapse. And, of course, NPR reporting this morning that this group of Israeli-trained Kenyan forces had secured the mall just an hour after the attack, but pulled out after their commander was fatally shot by Kenyan defense forces in an argument over who was in charge of the mission. There's the intra-Kenyan stuff. There's the connections outside of Kenya. Much more to come on this front. Nancy Cordes, we got this big climate panel report this week saying this headline, upper limit on emissions is nearing. Thorough consensus that it's humans, some plateau in the warming, but they say watch out. Is Congress talking about this, Nancy? They're talking about, you know, sort of the end of the world. Is it on the agenda in Washington?
Congress is really not talking about anything other than the budget, funding the government, and the debt ceiling right now. I mean, this is the kind of report that would normally create at least a bit of a splash. You'd have progressive senators, House members coming to the floor and sort of saying, this is the reason we need to do something. But look at all the other items on the public agenda that have sort of fallen off recently, like immigration. I mean, a lot has gone by the wayside while this fiscal fight takes over.
And it's not over. You've caught us up so very well today, and we're grateful for it. Nancy Cordes with CBS News. Nancy, it's always great to have you. Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
And David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for the New York Times. You're the best. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks so much, Tom. Great to be with you.
Jack, wonderful to have you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Abigail Collins, Austin Federa, and Emma Jean Weinstein. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Follow my tweets at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Love to see you there. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.